You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 164 by Rudolf Steiner, 11 lectures entitled The Value of Thinking for a Cognition that Satisfies the Human Being. This is Lecture 6, given in Dornach on the 27th of September, 1915. Translated by Christian von Arnim. Yesterday, following on from a characterization of the materialistic mechanical worldview by Mr. von Rangel, I also spoke of the poet Marie-Eugénie Delagrazie as an example of someone who really takes the materialistic worldview seriously. I might say takes it at its word. Now, we might well raise the question, how must a person who has elemental, strong feelings for everything human, which has been instilled in people through historical development, how must such a person feel if they take the materialistic, mechanical worldview as being true? This is roughly how, 25 to 30 years ago now, Marie-Eugénie Delagrazie approached the materialistic, mechanical worldview. She called Haeckel her master and assumed that, in a sense, the Laplacian mind was right in its conception of the world. But she did not express this worldview theoretically, but on the assumption that it is true, she also let human feeling speak. And so her poems are perhaps the most telling testimony to the way in which the feeling human heart can behave in our time in relation to the materialistic mechanical worldview, what can be felt, sensed, when it is taken as a prerequisite. And in order that you may have a rather vivid example of the impression made on a human heart by the materialistic mechanical view, we shall start by reciting to you some of these Delagrazie poems. The recitation is by Marie Steiner. Quote, at midnight, when tired and half intoxicated by the day's colorfully changing life, the earth dreams in blissful peace. The moon's bluish radiance floods the desolate streets, and blessed oblivion gently spreads its wings. In these blessed hours, so full of bliss and slumber, why, loudly beating heart, is it just you who can't find peace? Why, hot and fevered brow, does the army of tormenting thoughts, robbing slumber and scaring dreams away, swirl just through you? The stars move calmly in the sky above, and motionless the city lies, the vast, vast, huge metropolis. For, behold, it's midnight, and both poor and rich are given pleasure, without difference, by the dream god's beckoning cup, heavy and poppy-wreathed. Only you groan and whimper into your pillows at midnight, O wretched one, and weep and brood. For it is a demon who, dark and yet enchanting, hovers around your head, and demon whispers, scare away dreams, fairy-tale messengers from closer round, so that their lovely roundel dissipates wanly, and the night terrors of madness encircle you. And even if with shining eyes the bewitching lady fantasy beckons with golden wings, the poppy wreath and rejuvenating beauty's fiery potion of delight, your evil foe drives also this comforter away with his satanic grin, and gazing into your eyes, bewitching, stays for so long, wretch, at your bedside, until you spread your arms, press him to your heart, and wanting slavishly gasp just for him, a victim who willingly submits herself. Then he spreads his black demonic wings and shakes his locks in splendor of the night. With frozen kisses driving love and faith from out your soul, trickles the poison of despair into your breast, mauls with convulsive twitching predatory claws your heart, embracing you with fervor like a vampire would, and whispering with an icy smile, cognition is my name. number two. Nature, your begetter, holds you fast with iron bands, chaining you to dust and decay. Nature, the beckoning monster, presently smiling and with sunny sweetness, spurring you on to furious existential joy, presently giving birth to honor and distress, whipping you with the rod of woe, but always crushing and enigmatic, always Medusa and Sphinx at the same time. Through your pulses, chases, and races, and feverish beats, her merciless law, the eternal law of destruction. She gave you the will and strength to destroy yourself, but save yourself you never, ever can. On her triumphal chariot we all draw, wheezing, sweaty, and yet blissful too, for as a mirage, hope sways before us, and happiness, and every illusion created by her in mockery of us, which we, the army of slaves, poisoned by longing, call ideals. So in eager haste, and a great chase, we storm along, until treacherously, our strength leaves us, our breath fades, and further away than ever our goal hovers on golden clouds, until helpless and gasping we collapse. Then demonically she exults, then she calls out her cruel evil, and guides the iron spokes of her biga over 1,000 victims, crushing them. Number three. What cruel demon must have written the tormenting urge for love into our beating hearts? What treacherous, hellish delusion tells it to quiver with longing and foolishly to crave and thirst for divine delight, consuming itself for something infinite in feverish embers, and building over the seething swamp of finiteness the most enticing fairy realm of dreams? Ah! Lamenting and unresolved, this anxious question fades into eternity. Charmingly the divine smiles and waves to us in those puzzling hours. Yet we also want to snatch it, bind it, also see it in the garment of transience, and call out, chaining a second foolish eye to our fate, "Found! Found!" Yet only gods and fairy-tale heroes are refreshed by the nectar of eternal folly. The little people are guided by reason, and reason, the gluttonous ogress, she only nourishes and fortifies herself with shattered ideals. Disenchanted and shivering awakes the heart and the sober everyday soul, smiling at the dream that once intoxicated her. The shining star of divinity, she could not rip it from the sky, proud like a titan. No, she reached and stretched more foolish than a foolish child, after its dull reflection in the puddle of her own kind. Number four. Among the living there goes and passes from mouth to mouth a short word whispered in fright. Its brazen sound, it makes the rosy cheeks pale, the jubilant hymns of delusion, the dazzling, lying tales of existence are torn away and fade away with it for eternity. The crown of thorns of suffering, the rosaries of happiness, and diadems of glory, all of them, all are entwined, overgrown, and entangled by pale death's asphodel. For whom his wings rustle, they tremble, and for whom his hollow voice resounds, they have lied for the last time. Decay and mold ferment in our veins. Decay guides us according to its law, and what lives and breathes there, decay created it. Decay destroys it too. A dirty vortex of mystery and madness revolves around life and our pygmy kind. It revolves with it, in blind weakness, droll dignity, and powerlessness. All-conquering and free, the ogre Death rules on his own. With flashing sword he mows down the glistening lie of existence, and speaks for eternity, pointing to dust and decay, the one eternal truth. There is naught. Close quote. It is precisely from such an example, I believe, that we can see where the materialistic, mechanical view of the world must lead. If this world view had become the only dominant one and people had retained the possibility of feeling, then such a mood as that which speaks from these poems would have had to take hold of people in the widest circles, and only those who would have wanted to go on living without feeling, only those unfeeling people, would have been able to avoid being seized by such a mood. We do not learn to know the course of the world and to see through it in the right way by those merely theoretical thoughts with which people usually construct worldviews for themselves. But we only learn to know the supporting power of a worldview when we see it flowing into life. And I must say that it made a deep impression on me when, a very long time ago now, I saw the mechanical, materialistic worldview enter the brilliant soul, for it may be called a brilliant soul, of Marie Eugenie Delagrazzi. But we must also consider the preconditions that led a human heart to confront the mechanical, materialistic worldview in this way. After all, Marie Eugenie Delagrazzi is already, by her descent, what I would call a cosmopolitan figure. She has blood of all kinds of nationalities in her veins from her ancestors. She had already become acquainted with the sufferings of life in early childhood. And she had also learned in early childhood how to reach up in order to find something in addition to that which forms the outer meaning of life, something which carries this life through a higher power to something higher, because a Catholic priest who died some years ago became her teacher. The genius of Delagrazzi was demonstrated by the fact that in her 16th, 17th year she had already written a book of lyrical poetry, a comprehensive epic, a tragedy, and a small novella. No matter how much one might criticize these poems in one direction or another, genius is expressed in them in a captivating way. These poems came into my hands back then, when they were published in the 80s of the last century, and at the same time I heard talk of Delagrazzi through various acquaintances. I heard, for example, that the aesthetician Robert Zimmermann, who wrote an Aesthetics and a History of Aesthetics, and was an important representative of the Herbartian school of philosophers — the Herbartians are now extinct — and who was already an old man at that time, said Delagrazzi was the only real genius he had met in his life. Through various circumstances, I became personally acquainted with Delagrazzi and became friends with her, and we talked a lot about philosophical matters and other things. It was a significant lesson to see, on the one hand, Delagrazzi's teacher, the Catholic priest, who professionally steeped in Catholicism, had come to a worldview that he only expressed with irony and humor when he spoke more intimately, and, on the other hand, Delagrazzi herself. From the very first conversation I had with her, it was apparent that there was something profound about her with regard to the world and life. As a result of her upbringing by the priest, she had become acquainted with Catholic Christology, with all the possible bright aspects that one could get to know if one was close to Professor Müllner, that is, this priest, who for his part had also looked deeply into life. All this had taken shape in Delagrazzi in such a way that she connected everything that life brings in terms of evil and wickedness, pain and suffering, with the view of the world that had initially been given to her by this priest. You must bear in mind that I am talking about a 17-year-old girl. So that from this arose the idea of a poem, which she discussed with me in a long conversation. She wanted to write a Satanide — readers aside, like suicide, but Satanide, S-A-T-A-N-I-D-E, and a readers aside. She wanted to show how suffering and pain are in the world, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the worldview that was handed down to her. Now, into such a soul fell the materialistic, mechanical worldview. The latter is very persuasive, unfolds a huge force of logic, so that people can only escape it with difficulty. I later asked Delagrazzi why she had not written the Satanide. She told me that since, according to the materialistic mechanical view, she did not believe in God, and therefore not in the opponent of God, Satan, either, She could not write to Satanide if she was to stay true to her feeling. But she had a tremendous power of human experience, and she then elaborated it in the great two-volume epic Robespierre, which is completely permeated by such moods as you have heard. I heard her read aloud many of the cantos herself while they were still in the making. Two women once became nauseous while this was happening. They couldn't listen to the end. This is characteristic of how people veil things for themselves. They believe in the science of materialism, but if you were to show them the consequence, they would faint. The materialistic worldview truly makes people weak and cowardly. They look at the world through a veil and still want to be Christians. And that in particular, subsequently, seemed to Marie-Eugénie Della Grazie to be the worst thing in existence. She said something like this to herself, "Everything is just swirling atoms, jumbled atoms. What are these jumbled atoms doing? They cluster together. After they have clustered together into cosmic bodies, after they have made plants grow, they cluster together into human beings and human brains. And in these ideals arise, through that clustering of atoms, ideals of beauty, of all kinds of greatness, of all kinds of divinity. What a terrible existence it is," she said to herself, "when atoms swirl, and swirl in such a way that they make people believe in the existence of ideals. The whole existence of the world is deception and mendacity." So say those who are not too cowardly to face the ultimate implications of the materialistic mechanical worldview. Della Grazie says, "If it were at least truthful, this world of jumbled atoms, then we would have jumbled atoms in front of us in our minds. But in this way, the jumbled atoms still deceive us, lie to us as if there were ideals in the world." So when we have learned to recognize what consequences the human mind must draw when it relates in honesty to the materialistic mechanical worldview, then we have again one of the reasons for working on a spiritual worldview. Those who always say, "We have everything, we have our ideals, we have what Christianity has brought so far," they must be answered, "Has it not been the way we have behaved that has brought us to the powerful, mechanical, materialistic worldview? Do you wish to continue like this?" Those who want to demonstrate the unnecessary nature of our movement, because this or that is put forward from other sides, should reflect that despite these other sides having worked for centuries, the mechanistic, materialistic worldview has become great. It is simply a matter of striving to grasp life where it occurs in truth. What matters is not what we think, but that we look at the facts and let the facts teach us. I have often mentioned that I once gave a lecture in a town about Christianity from the standpoint of spiritual science. Two priests were also there. They came up to me after the lecture and said, "Well, that's all well and good what you're saying, but the way you present it, only a few people will understand it. More correct is how we present the matter, because that is for all people." To which I could say nothing other than, "Excuse me, but do all people really come to you? That you believe it is for all people, that doesn't decide anything about the matter. But what does is what is real. And so you will not be able to deny that many people no longer come to you. And it is for these that we speak, because they too must find the way to Christ. That's how you speak when you don't take the easy way out, when you don't simply think your own opinion is good, but let yourself be guided by the facts. That is why it is not enough either, as you saw yesterday, to read the sentences of such a text as Rangel's, one after the other, but that you build on it what can be built on it. I would like to give you an example, and this can be done in various ways, of how different writings can be discussed in our branches, and how what lives in our spiritual science can emerge clearly by measuring it against what is discussed in such pamphlets. The next chapter in Rangel's pamphlet is called, quote, "Formation of the Concepts." That which surrounds the human being takes many forms. Each thing is distinct from the other. Even if several things agree in some of their properties, that is, if they evoke the same or similar sensory impressions, they nevertheless differ in at least one attribute. Everything that I perceive through my senses occupies a certain part of space at the time. For greater clarity in this multifaceted world, humans group similar things, that is, things with similar characteristics, together under common names. For these mentally generated concepts, they form words. They also designate the same or similar properties, such as red, hard, warm, hot, etc., by words. Close quote. Here, Mr. von Wrangel speaks about the formation of concepts in a way that is very popular, and is very often presented in this way. People say to themselves, I see a red flower, a second, a third red flower, of a certain shape and arrangement of petals, and since I find them the same, I form a concept about them together. A concept would therefore be formed in such a way that I group together what is the same in different things. For example, the term horse is formed by my combining, in a certain way, a number of animals that have certain similarities into a single thought, into a single conception. I can do the same with properties. I see something with a certain color shade, something else with a similar color shade, and form the concept of the color red. But if you want to get to the heart of the matter, you have to ask yourself, is this really the way to form concepts? I can only give some indications right now, otherwise we would never get through the text, because you can actually always attach the whole world to anything. To illustrate how Mr. von Wrangel represents concepts being formed, I will choose a geometrical example. Suppose we saw different things in the world, and we found something with a boundary like this one time, something with a boundary like this another time, and something with a boundary like this the third time, and so on countless times. We often see these boundaries, which are so similar to each other, and now we would form the concept of circle, according to Mr. von Wrangel's definition. But do we really form the concept of a circle in accordance with such similar delimitations? No. We only form the concept of a circle when we do the following. Here is a point that has a certain distance from this point. There is a point that is again the same distance from that point, and there is another point that is the same distance, and so on. I look for all points that have the same distance from a certain point. If I connect these points, I get a line that I call a circle. And I get the concept of a circle when I can say, the circle is a line in which all points are equidistant from the center. Now I have a formula, and that leads me to the concept. The inner work on it, the inner construction, actually leads to the concept. Not until someone knows how to make concepts in this way, how to reconstruct what exists outside in the world, do they have a right to speak of concepts. We do not find the concept of a horse by looking at 100 horses to find out what is the same about them, but we find the essence of the horse by reconstructing it, and then we find what has been reconstructed in each horse. This moment of activity when we form conceptions, concepts, is often forgotten. In this chapter, too, it has been forgotten to consider the moment of inner activity. The next chapter is called, quote, Conceptions of Space and Time. The sense of touch in combination with vision creates the idea of space. The direct experience of the succession of sensations leads us to the notion of time. Space and time are the forms of thought in which our conceptions of the world outside of us are formed, as far as we perceive it through our five senses. The conception of movement as the change in the position of a thing in space within a period of time is likewise an original conception, given at first by the movement of our own body. When things that we perceive through our senses evoke the same sensory impressions in us, within a certain period of time, we gain the idea of being, of existing. If, on the other hand, the impressions received from the same thing change, we gain the idea of happening. Close quote. So, in a neat way, as the saying goes, Mr. von Wrangel seeks to gain conceptions about the concepts of space and time, of movement, being, and happening. Now, it would be most interesting to study how everything in this chapter is nevertheless, I would like to say, rather scant. it would be quite good for many. I do not want to say for you in particular, my dear friends, but for many people, if they would consider that a very perceptive man, an excellent scientist, forms such conceptions, makes every effort to form conceptions about these simple terms. At the very least, we can learn a lot from it about conscientious thinking, and that is important because there are so many people who don't even feel the need, before thinking about anything, the cosmos, to first ask themselves, how do I arrive at the simple ideas of being, happening, and movement? That is usually too boring for people. Well, a deeper look would show that the concepts as formed by Mr. von Wrangel are nevertheless rather scant. For example, Mr. von Wrangel says, without further ado, quote, the sense of touch in conjunction with sight produces the idea of space, close quote. Just consider, my dear friends, if you do not use the blackboard to draw a circle, but draw the circle in your imagination, what does the sense of touch have to do with it? What does sight have to do with it? Given that, might we still be able to say, quote, the sense of touch in conjunction with vision creates the conception of space? Close quote. We cannot. However, someone might object that before we can draw a circle in our imagination, we must have gained a conception of space, and this is gained through the sense of touch in connection with sight. Surely it is a question of considering, for a start, what kind of conception we form at the moment when we touch something through the sense of touch. If we think of ourselves as gifted only with the sense of touch, and that we touch something, we form the idea that what is being touched is outside us. Now, take this sentence. Quote, the thing touched is outside us, close quote. In the outside us lies space. That is, when we touch an object, we must, so that we can carry out the touching in the first place, already have space within us. It was this that led Kant to assume that space precedes all external experiences. Thus also the experience of touching and seeing, and likewise with regard to time, that it precedes the multiplicity of processes in time. That space and time are the preconditions of sensory perception. Basically, such a chapter about space and time could only be written by someone who has not only studied Kant thoroughly, but also knows the whole course of philosophy in general. Otherwise, you will always have slightly scant concepts in relation to space and time. It is the same with the other concepts, the concepts of being and of happening. There it could easily be shown how the concept of being could not exist at all if the definition given by Mr. von Wrangel were correct. For he says, quote, if things that we perceive through our senses evoke the same sensory impressions within a certain period of time, we gain the conception of being, of existence. If, on the other hand, the impressions received from the same thing change, we obtain the conception of happening. Close quote. We could just as well say, if we see that the sensations change in the same thing, then we must presuppose that this change adheres to something that has existence, occurs in something that has existence. We could just as well claim that it is only through change that being is recognized. And whoever wanted to claim that we only arrive at the concept of being when the same impressions are evoked within a certain time, just think, if we wanted to arrive at the concept of being in this way, then it would be possible that we could not arrive at the concept of being at all. There would be nothing at all that could be connected with the concept of being. We can learn from this chapter, concepts of space and time, in particular how, with great acumen and extraordinarily honest scholarship, we can find concepts that are tenuous in all sorts of places. If we want to form concepts that can stand up to life a little, then we must have obtained them in such a way that they have been tested by us, at least to some extent, with regard to their value for life. You see, it is for this reason I said I had only found the courage to speak to you about the last scenes of Faust, because for more than 30 years I had lived again and again in the last scenes of Faust, testing the concepts in life. This is the only way to distinguish valid concepts from non-valid ones. Not logical speculation, not scientific theorizing, but the attempt to live with the concepts, to examine how the concepts prove themselves by introducing them into life and letting life give us the answer. That is the necessary path. This presupposes, however, that we are at all times inclined not merely to surrender to logical conceits, but to join the living stream of life. This has a number of consequences. Above all, that we learn to believe that if someone can produce seemingly logical proofs for this or that, I have mentioned this many times, they have by no means yet produced anything that relates to the value of the matter. The next chapter is called, quote, The Principle of Causality. The principle of causality that underlies our thinking forces us to assume that if something happens, that is, a change takes place, a cause must have brought it about. All rational thinking is based on the principle of sufficient reason. Everything has a reason for being. Every change in what exists is brought about by a reason. This principle is not an empirical proposition. It precedes all experience. Indeed, it makes it possible in the first place, because without the presupposition expressed in it, no coherent thinking is possible. Close quote. Mr. Van Rangel here adopts the standpoint of the so-called principle of causality. He says all rational thinking must assume in everything that confronts us that there is an underlying cause. We can agree to some extent with this principle of causality. However, if we want to measure its significance for our life-filled view of the world, then we must field much, much more subtle concepts than this formal principle of causality. For you see, in order to be able to state a cause, or a complex of causes, of a thing, much more is necessary than merely following, as it were, the thread of cause and effect. Basically, what does the principle of causation say? It says a thing has a cause. The thing I am drawing here, brackets, there is no record of the drawing, has a cause. This cause has a cause in turn, and so on. We can carry on like this beyond the beginning of the world, and we can also do the same with the effect. Certainly, this is a very reasonable principle, but you don't get very far with it. For example, if you look for the cause of a son, we must certainly look for causes, complex causes, in the father and mother, in order to be able to say that these are the causes of the child. But it is undoubtedly also the case that such causes can be there but have no effect, namely, when a woman and a man don't have a child. Then the causes are there, but have no effect. With a cause, it is important that it is not just a cause, but that it also causes something. There is a difference between being a cause and causing. But even the philosophers of our time do not yet allow themselves to be drawn into such subtle distinctions. But anyone who takes things seriously has to deal with such distinctions. In reality, the issue is not that causes are there, but that they cause something. Concepts that exist in this way need not yet correspond to reality, but one can indulge in a great fantasy with them. Goethe's worldview is fundamentally different from this, in that it does not go to the causes, but to the archetypal phenomena. That is something quite different. For Goethe traces something that exists in the world as a phenomenon, let us say that certain series of colors appear in the prism, back to the archetypal phenomenon, to the interaction between matter and light. Or, if we take matter as representative of darkness, between darkness and light. In the same way, he goes into the archetypal phenomenon of the plant, the animal, and so on. This is a worldview that faces the facts and does not merely continue spinning concepts logically, following the thread of logic, but groups the facts in such a way that they express a truth. Try to read what Goethe wrote in his essay, quote, The Experiment as Mediator Between Subject and Object, close quote, and also what I was able to publish as a supplement to this essay, and also try to read what I said in my introductions to Goethe's scientific writings, entitled Kirchner's Deutsche Nationalliteratur. then you will see that Goethe's view of nature is based on something quite different from that of modern natural scientists. We must take the phenomena and group them not as they are there in nature, but so that they speak their secrets to us. To find the archetypal phenomenon from the phenomena, that is the essential thing. That is also what I wanted to indicate yesterday when I said that you have to go into the facts. What we think about the mechanical, materialistic worldview matters little. But if you can show how in 1872 one of its representatives stood before the assembled natural scientists in Leipzig and said, "To trace all natural events back to the movements of atoms is the task of natural science," then you are pointing to a fact. We might say to an archetypal phenomenon of historical development. Tracing historical development back to archetypal phenomena is shown by pointing to what Dubois-Raymond has pronounced, for this is an archetypal phenomenon in the process of the materialistic mechanical worldview. If we proceed in this way, we learn no longer to think as if we were in a glass compartment, but to think in such a way that we become an instrument for the facts that speak their secrets, and we can then test by our thinking whether it really conforms to the facts. Truly, not in order to make a name for myself, but in order to recount my own experiences as far as possible, I will mention the following. I prefer to talk about concepts that have been experienced rather than all kinds of thought-up concepts. Those who want to believe that what I am about to say is said in order to gain prestige may believe it, but it is not so. When I tried to present Goethe's worldview in the 1880s, I said, on the basis of what you find when you live your way into it, Goethe must once have written an essay that expresses the most intimate part of his scientific outlook. And I said, after recreating the essay, this essay must have been there, at least in Goethe's mind. You will find this in my introduction to Goethe's scientific writings. You will also find the recreated essay there. I then joined the Goethe archive, and there I found the essay just as I had created it. So you have to go with the facts. Those who seek wisdom, let the facts speak. However, that is the more inconvenient thing, because you have to deal with the facts. You don't have to deal with the thoughts that happen to come. The next chapter is called, quote, "Applying the Notion of Arbitrariness to the World Around Us." Since our sentiment is that from which we, as the immediately given, proceed in all thinking, we also judge that which we address as the external world, initially, according to what is going on within us, close quote. If I were to read titled Truth and Knowledge to you, I could show you which is the right thought, the right understanding, and how here again there is a slightly scant thinking. I would like to know, firstly, how there would ever be mathematics if we started from our sentiments and all our thinking. Then we would never be able to arrive at mathematics. For what is our sentiment supposed to be in the question, what is the sum of the squares of the two legs of a right-angled triangle in relation to the square of the hypotenuse? But Rangel says, quote, "Since our sentiment is that from which we, as the immediately given, proceed in all thinking, we also judge what we address as the external world, first of all, according to what goes on within us." Close quote. You can't do much with this sentence. Let us see further, quote, "We have the awareness that those changes in the surroundings, which we ourselves consciously bring about by movements of our limbs, are brought about by inner processes, which we call will impulses. This is why the unbiased person initially assumes similar causes for other changes in the surroundings. That is, they assume that they too are caused by will impulses from beings that are similar to them. The mythologies of all peoples are the expressions of this anthropomorphic bringing to life of nature and the belief in spiritual beings, which even now serves for many people to explain many events in the surrounding world, has the same origin. Lastly, the observation of the child shows that they even attribute a will similar to their own to inanimate objects. they bump into the table and scold the table for such naughtiness. Close quote. I have often said the child bumps into the table and hits the table because it places a will in it. It judges the table as being like itself, because it has not yet developed a conception of a table. It is exactly the reverse that is the case, and the next chapter also suffers from this confusion. Quote, observation of uniformly proceeding phenomena. If, therefore, many events are at first attributed by the human being to free will impulses, daily observation, nevertheless, shows them that with regard to some phenomena, they can count with certainty on a regular repetition familiar to them. They know, for example, that after the sun sets in the west, it will reappear in the east the next day, that light and warmth are associated with it. They know that the regular course of the seasons influences the life of plants, etc. This knowledge enables people to organize their actions accordingly. They soon find that the more closely they observe nature, the more regularities they discover in it, the better they are able to put themselves in harmony with it. Close quote. If we want to speak of regularities in nature in this way, then we must not disregard the fact that we speak of such regularities in quite different ways. I drew attention to this in title, Truth and Knowledge. Let's say, for example, I get dressed in the morning, go to the window, and see a person passing by outside. The next morning I get dressed again, look out the window again, and the person passes by again. The same thing happens on the third morning and again on the fourth. I see a regularity there. The first thing I do is get dressed, then go to the window. The next thing is that I see the person walking out there. I see a regularity because the processes repeat themselves. So I form a judgment, and it would have to be, because I get dressed and because I look out of the window, that's why the person outside passes by. We don't make such judgments, of course, because it would be mad. But in other cases, it seems that we do. But in reality, we don't do it even then. But we form concepts, and from the inner construction of the concepts, we find that there is an inner regularity in the phenomena. Because I cannot construct a causality between my getting dressed, looking out the window, and what is going on outside, I do not recognize any causality. You can find this in greater detail in Title Truth and Knowledge. You will find there all the premises, including the one presented by David Hume, in order for us to learn something about the regularity of the world from repetition. The next chapter is called, quote, The Essence of All Science. This is probably the beginning of all science, the essence of which is to summarize facts of experience in a clear way in order to extract rules from them that enable the human being to know in advance what will happen. That is why every science contains a descriptive part, the clear compilation of facts, and a theoretical part, the extraction of rules from these facts, and the conclusions to be drawn from these rules. Close quote. Goethe objected to such conclusions. Did Galileo need to see many phenomena, like the swinging church lamp in the Cathedral of Pisa, in order to arrive at his law of free fall? No, he recognized the law after seeing this phenomenon. That's when it hit him. It is not from the repetition of the facts, but from the inwardly experienced construction of the facts, that we learn something about the essence of things. It was a basic error of recent epistemology to assume that we can obtain anything like the laws of nature by summarizing the facts. It so blatantly contradicts all real obtaining of the laws of nature, and yet it is repeated over and over again. The next chapter. Quote, Astronomy, the Oldest Science. If we look around in the immeasurable realm of what we perceive through our senses, we will find no group of phenomena in which the regularity of events is so conspicuous, so easy to discover and express, as the apparent movement of the heavenly bodies. It is therefore understandable that astronomy is the oldest of all sciences based on sensory perception. It is, above all, the regular, apparent movement of the stars, repeated day after day, which captivates the attentive observer, stimulates them to observe, and urges them to form a vivid conception. In the cloudless regions of the Near East and North Africa, the external conditions were particularly favorable for the study of celestial phenomena. Following their direct sensory impression, the ancient astronomers assumed that the countless fixed stars, which remain unchanged in their reciprocal position, were attached to a transparent but solid celestial sphere in the center of which rests the Earth. The celestial sphere rotating evenly around an axis gave a vivid conception of the perceived process. Close quote. So the chapter is called Astronomy, the Oldest Science. Now we should actually first go into what the oldest astronomy was like, for here we must consider above all that the oldest astronomy did not look at the regularity, but at the will of the spiritual beings who cause the movements. The author, however, has today's astronomy in mind and stamps it as the oldest science. Sometimes it is really necessary to pursue the truth in the method you use in a completely unvarnished way, that is, with an unvarnished method. And when the chapter here on page 13 is called Astronomy, the Oldest Science, I compare that, because I stick to the facts and don't speculate, with what is written on page 3. There it says, quote, that by training I am an astronomer, close quote. Perhaps someone who is a mathematician or physiologist would come to a different conclusion. So we should not forget what is written on page 3. It is of great importance to point to the subjective motives in a person, much more than is usually done, because these subjective motives usually begin to explain what needs to be explained. But in terms of subjective motives, people really are quite peculiar. They want to admit to themselves as little as possible of subjective motives. I have often mentioned a gentleman whom I met and who said that in doing this or that, it was above all important for him not to do what he wanted to do according to his personal preference, but to do what corresponded least to his personal preference, what he had to regard as the mission imposed on him by the spiritual world. It was of no use to explain to him that he must also count finger-licking as part of his spiritual mission, when he said to himself, I do everything according to the mission imposed on me by the spiritual world. He masked it, however, because he liked it better when he could present as a strict sense of duty what he was so terribly fond of doing. The next chapter, quote, Uniform Movement. When we speak of uniformity in the movement of an object, we mean that the object in question passes through equal sections of space in equal segments of time. Close quote, Steiner again. Remember the lecture on speed I once gave here in this volume? Quote, however, mere perception is not enough to determine this. Readers aside, I believe this is von Rangel again, end of readers aside. One must be able to measure both sections of space and segments of time. Only when we are able to express both sections of space and segments of time in numbers through measurement, that is, through comparison with an unchanging, uniform quantity chosen as a unit, only then can the actual uniformity of a movement, as well as the effect of a certain cause, which is always the same in terms of magnitude, be proven experientially. Close quote. This is where the learned scientist begins to speak. You need only look around a little to see what craving pervades scientists to strive for objectivity by measuring what is independent of the subjective human being, by striving to apply objective standards. This happens most objectively when we really are measuring. That is why real science is considered to be that which is obtained through measurement. That is why Mr. von Rangel speaks of measurement itself in the next chapter. Quote, measuring. Every measurement operation is based on the assumption that the unit chosen, for example a meter, a gram, a second, etc., is invariable. We cannot prove this unconditionally of our measurements, but we can be sure that our measuring operations are correct within certain limits that we can recognize. Let us give an illustrative example to explain what has been said. We want to compare the length of two objects and measure them with the same meter stick, assuming that it retains its length. However, we know that all bodies change under the influence of temperature, humidity, etc., so our meter stick may also have become longer or shorter. Without knowing the size of the presumed change, we have, however, a reasonable belief that the change cannot have reached the magnitude of, say, 1 millimeter in such a short time. We can therefore be sure that we have not made an error in this measurement that exceeds 1 millimeter for every meter measured. Through such a measurement operation, we have gained an empirical fact, in our case the ratio of two lengths, which is valid for us within the limits of accuracy to be established by critique. Close quote. Steiner again. This is a very nice little chapter, where it is made clear how measurement can initially tell us something about proportions. The next chapter, quote, "The Principle Underlying Clocks." It is similar with measuring periods of time. The instruments used for this purpose, clocks, are essentially based on the conviction that the same causes produce the same effects. The ancients mostly used water clocks, clepsydras, for this purpose, in which the outflow of water from a container was kept under as uniform conditions as possible, the water level kept at the same height, the outflow tube of a certain shape, etc. And the magnitude of the period of time was deduced from the amount of water that flowed out. Our pendulum clocks are based on the perception that all other things being equal, the speed of a pendulum swing depends on the length of the pendulum. By ensuring that the length remains as constant as possible, that the resistance is as low as possible, and that the force which overcomes it acts evenly, one achieves the even running of a clock. There are methods to check this movement, whereby one can indicate exactly by how much at the maximum the clock has moved too much or too little in the course of, for example, one day. Close quote. You see, this chapter is so good because you can bring to mind, in simple terms, how we cut corners in life, so to speak. We can easily see this if we stay with the old clocks, the water clocks, for the time being. Suppose a man who had used the water clock said, "It took me 3 hours to do this work." What does that mean? Everyone understands that kind of thing, you'd think. But people do not consider that in doing so they are already relying on certain preconditions. For the person concerned should actually have said, if he had expressed facts, "While I was working, so and so much water flowed out from the beginning to the end of my work." Instead of always saying, "From the beginning to the end of my work, this much water flowed out," we have compared the flow of water with the course of the sun and have used an abbreviation, the formula, "I have worked for 3 hours." We then continue to use this formula. We think we have something factual in mind, but we have omitted one thought, namely, "So and so much of the water has flowed out." We only have the second thought as an abbreviation. But by giving ourselves the possibility of such a fact becoming formulistic, we are moving away from the fact. And now think for a moment that in life we don't just combine a job and a formula, but that we talk in formulas in general, really talk in formulas. Just think, for example, what it means, quote, "to be diligent," close quote. If we go back to the facts, there are a tremendous amount of facts underlying the formula, quote, "to be hardworking," close quote. We have seen many things happen and compared them to the time in which they can happen, and so we speak of, quote, "being hardworking," close quote. A whole army of facts is contained in this, and often we utter such formulas without reflecting on the facts. When we return to the facts, we feel the need to put our thoughts in a living way and not to speak in nebulous formulas. I once heard a professor lecture who began a course on literary history by saying, "When we turn to Lessing, in order to consider his style, let us first ask ourselves how Lessing used to think about the world, what his way of working was, how he intended to use it, and so on." And after questioning like this for an hour, he said, "Gentlemen, I have led you into a forest of question marks. But now imagine a, quote, forest of question marks," close quote. Imagine that you want to go for a walk in this forest of question marks. Think what that feels like. Well, From this man I have also heard the saying that these or those people throw themselves into a, in quotes, bath of fire. I always had to think what people look like when they throw themselves into a fire bath like that. You often meet people who do not realize how far they are removed from reality. If you delve into their words, into their conceptions of words, and try to make clear to yourself what their words mean, then you will find that everything dissipates and scatters in the wind, because what people say in this way is not at all possible in reality. So you can learn quite a lot, really quite a lot, in these perceptive chapters on measuring and on the principle underlying clocks. I cannot now say with certainty when I will be able to continue to discuss the subsequent chapters of this booklet. Today I would just like to say still that, of course, I only wanted to highlight examples, and that, of course, this can be done in 100 different ways. But if we do this, we will ensure that we are not cocooned in our spiritual scientific movement, but that we really extend threads into the whole world. For that would be the worst thing of all, my dear friends, if we were to cocoon ourselves. I have pointed out that the thinking is of particular importance and significance, and that is why it is important that we take some of the things that have come before our souls in the last few weeks in such a way that we think about them. Do not take them in the most one-sided way, and wish to put them into practice in our lives. When, for example, mystical eccentricity has been mentioned, then this has been done with good reason. But if you now think in turn that you should no longer speak of spiritual experiences, then that would be the greatest nonsense. If spiritual experiences are true, they are realities. The important thing is that they are true, and that we stay within the spiritual boundaries. It is important that we do not go from one extreme to the other. It is more important that we really try not only to accept spiritual science as such, but that we also become aware that spiritual science must be integrated into the fabric of the world. Certainly, it would also be wrong to believe that we should no longer do spiritual science at all, but only read such pamphlets in the branches. That would be another incorrect interpretation. You have to think about what I meant, but the great harm I have indicated, that many just copy everything down instead of listening, is prevented in that we do not just copy everything down, but listen. For if, when copying down, only such stuff is produced as really happens when copying down lectures, and if we believe that we certainly need such copied down lectures, well, my dear friends, then I must say that first of all, we show that we attach little importance to what has appeared in print, for there is really plenty of material that has already been printed. And secondly, it is not at all necessary that we are always scrambling for the very latest. This is a habit adopted by people as a result of journalism, and we must not cultivate it among ourselves. Thoroughly working through what is available is something fundamental and meaningful, and we will not spoil listening closely for ourselves by copying everything down, but will have the desire to listen closely. Because scribbling everything down seldom results in anything other than spoiling the attention, we might develop while listening. Therefore, I believe that those of us who want to work in the branches will, if they think they have no material, find the opportunity to have such material after all. You will no longer need to tug at the sleeve of everyone who has scribbled them down to get transcriptions of lectures, just so that you can always read out the very latest. Truly, it depends on a serious approach, and the fact that not much serious work has been done in this direction is evident in many phenomena, even if indirectly, from which we are actually ailing. So, my dear friends, I don't know for sure yet, but when I can manage again, I will continue, perhaps on Saturday, the discussion of Mr. von Rangel's excellent perceptive pamphlet, which I have chosen because it is written by a scientist and has a concurring rather than a negative content. The end of Lecture 6.